Hello again, and welcome back to the ESVS podcast. In this series of podcasts entitled Vascular Fundamentals, we are going back to basics. My name is Justin Woolgar.
And I am Jonna Hallmann.
So grab yourself a cup of tea or coffee and let's get underway.
In the last episode, we broke down the relationship between pressure, flow and resistance and why the role that each of these plays is important in vascular surgery. In this episode, we continue to look at arterial hemodynamics, especially in relation to exercise, claudication, limb ischemia, and aneurysms. Let's start by looking at exercise.
Before we start talking about exercise, I need to find my treadmill. Now, where did I put it? One moment, please. Boys and girls, as you can hear, I've just stepped onto my treadmill and doing a bit of exercise, something I don't do that often. One thing I like about treadmills is the tray in front of the control panel where you can hold your beer and your takeaway portion of chips while you exercise. Got to replace those calories as quickly as you lose them, you know. Excuse me a minute, I'm just going to take a bite of my burger. Oops, I just seem to have lost a bit of tomato on the treadmill. But not stepping it. Never mind. It will just end up falling behind at the end of the conveyor belt. Just give me a minute. I'm just going to get rid of all this lettuce and the gherkin. Chuck that onto the treadmill. Never was much of a fan of salad anyway. This is really great because not only am I giving my mesenteric circulation a little bit of a workout, but I'm also exercising my legs at the same time. How good is that? Anyway, I think we better get back to the podcast. Feeling a bit sweaty, but the burger was nice. Before stepping on the treadmill, blood flow in each of my legs averages about 300 to 400 mils per minute. During exercise, this can increase 5 to 10 times, and when you stop, the blood flow rapidly subsides to resting levels within a minute or two. The underlying mechanism is arterial vasodilation, producing a drop in peripheral resistance and increased flow as a result of increased cardiac output. A similar effect is seen when a limb is rendered ischemic with a tourniquet and then released after 5 minutes. The vasodilation produces what we call reactive hyperemia.
What about the pressure changes during exercise?
I bet you didn't know that the actual mean pressure drop across normal arteries from the heart to the ankles is only a few millimeters of mercury. As the pressure wave travels distally, there is an increase in systolic pressure and a decrease in diastolic pressure, causing the pulse pressure to widen. This is due to reflection of waves from the high resistance peripheral arteriolar bed. You may recall from when performing ABPI measurements that the ankle systolic pressure in normal individuals exceeds the brachial pressure by about 10%. In normal extremities, moderate exercise produces little or no drop in peripheral pressure at the ankles, and even in strenuous exercise, there may only be a small drop of a few millimeters of mercury, which usually recovers after a minute or two. This is all very different in patients with occlusive arterial disease, as we are about to find out. We're all familiar with intermittent claudication, which occurs when blood flow to the exercising muscle mass is unable to meet the requirements of the greater metabolic activity. The cramping muscular discomfort is thought to be due to the buildup of metabolites within the muscle, which causes the pain. In patients with claudication, the resting blood flow is normal or nearly normal. However, during exercise, the blood flow is far less than that observed in normal limbs. In severe disease, the distal tissues may actually become profoundly ischemic. Furthermore, after cessation of exercise, the hyperemic period is also greatly prolonged and can last up to 30 minutes. The combination of exercise and hyperemia produce a drop in peripheral resistance in a system with compromised flow. What this means is that any significant arterial stenosis results in a precipitous drop in pressure distal to the lesion. Even if the stenosis is not that severe to produce a drop in pressure at rest, exercise or hyperemia will cause a drop in pressure. This explains the observation of disappearing pedal pulses after exercise. In an ischemic limb with rest pain, all of these changes are amplified because the vascular bed is already maximally dilated. Therefore, blood flow does not increase that much with exercise.
You've explained the pressure and flow changes that occur in claudication for a single obstructing lesion, in, for example, the superficial femoral artery. What happens when there are multiple stenosis or obstructions?
Ah, good point. We generally know that lesions in one arterial segment commonly cause claudication, but rarely ischemic rest pain. Having said that, there are exceptions. For instance, if an occlusion occurs very distally, such as in the foot or toe, where there are no collaterals available, and end artery ischemia will occur. The other situation where this might occur is during an embolic occlusion of the distal aorta, common femoral or popliteal artery, where retrograde thrombosis usually occurs and takes out stem or re-entry collaterals. In this scenario, we have what is in effect a multi-level occlusion, which can lead to severe acute ischemia. We often use the expression multi-level disease in peripheral arterial disease to describe the distribution of stenotic or occlusive lesions in two or more major arterial segments. Blood flow is more severely compromised because it has to traverse two or more high resistance collateral beds. A good example of this in practice is illustrated by a chronic occlusion in the iliac and femoral systems, which often leads to severe claudication but rarely results in ischemic rest pain. Occlusions in three segments, for example, the iliac, the femoral, and popliteal sections, often will result in severe ischemia, and we often see this in practice.
What happens to the flow dynamics in this situation during exercise?
Imagine the scenario where there is a stenosis in your iliac artery and you are also unfortunate to have a further narrowing in your superficial femoral artery. Resting blood flow to the calf is maintained by nearly complete vasodilation of the calf vessels and partial vasodilation of the thigh vasculature. During exercise, further vasodilation of the thigh vasculature occurs, lowering the peripheral resistance, resulting in a drop in pressure and flow to the calf muscles. In this situation, we have one vascular bed stealing from another, the so-called vascular steal phenomena. This can also happen when there is a proximal stenosis in the iliac artery feeding a fem-fem crossover graft. The donor limb is potentially at risk of becoming symptomatic because of the reduction in perfusion pressure. The other well-known situation where this can occur is in the subclavian artery, where a proximal stenosis or occlusion causes flow reversal in the ipsilateral vertebral artery when the arm is exercised.
If exercise only produces a moderate increase in blood flow, why do we recommend it so much for intermittent claudication?
As you'd expect in surgery, the answer is a little more complicated. Yes, exercise does improve blood flow through the collateral beds. However, in claudicants, the resistance of these is already maximally reduced, so probably makes little difference. This would explain why vasodilator drugs are of limited value in this situation. Exercise improves walking distance in claudicants, most likely by improving walking efficiency. pain tolerance and various metabolic adaptations in the muscle. The often stated mechanism of improved collateral development is probably unlikely to play a significant role.
You've talked a lot about how exercise can improve blood flow to a certain degree, but practice tells us that the best way to improve blood flow is by reducing the degree of the obstruction through dilating the stenosis with balloon or performing a bypass. What hemodynamic issue do we have to be aware of with vascular grafts?
When we choose a graft for a bypass, there are several considerations we need to take into account. First, it needs to be large enough to carry the blood flow at rest and also be able to accommodate the increased flow during exercise. If we look at a standard length 40 centimetre prosthetic graft, the pressure drop across a 6 millimetre diameter graft is fairly small, even at high flow rates. Using a 3 millimetre graft would cause a pressure drop of at least 45 millimetres of mercury at flow rates of 500 mils per minute, making it pretty useless during exercise. One concept we have to mention when talking about arterial grafts is the shear rate. This is the rate at which the velocity of flow changes between concentric laminae of blood. Fundamental to this concept is that there will be an infinitesimally thin layer of blood that is in immediate contact with the vessel and which remains static and will transmit the forces of motion onto the vessel wall, what we call the shear stress. The shear rate and stress are dependent on viscosity and are directly proportional to the mean velocity of flow and inversely proportional to the inner radius of the vessel. A high flow rate, and therefore high shear rate, is associated with the formation of a thin, tightly adherent pseudo-intima within the graft, which will affect the overall inside diameter. This is something that will need to be considered when choosing the appropriate diameter for your bypass graft. On the basis of this, a 6 millimetre graft would be fine for a fempop bypass, and a 7 millimetre diameter graft would be suitable for an aortobifemoral limb.
Are you saying that the wider the graft, the better it will perform?
The answer to that question is, of course, yes and no. If the graft is too wide, what tends to happen is thrombus formation within the lumen of the graft as the flow tries to mould itself to the inside of the graft in a similar fashion to an aneurysm. This can lead to pieces of clot breaking off, resulting in failure of the graft and, on occasion, distal embolisation. A compromise has to be met where the graft is small enough to maintain high velocity of flow but large enough to avoid restriction of flow in high-demand situations.
What about the flow dynamics and the graft arterial anastomosis?
That's where things can get complicated. The traditional bypass, be it with a venous or prosthetic graft, is usually performed as an end-to-side anastomosis. And we know from our previous discussions that when blood flow changes direction, a lot of things can happen. Inertial factors play a big role in the energy loss, and the larger the angle the graft anastomosis makes with the artery, the greater the energy losses. Having said that, any pressure drop is unlikely to be clinically significant, despite the energy loss increasing several fold by an adverse angle of the graft. We know that any point along a conduit, such as a graft, where flow division occurs, be it a branch or an anastomosis, flow disturbances and turbulence occur, resulting in zones of flow separation, stagnation, and distorted velocity vectors. The toe and the heel of the anastomosis are particularly susceptible to flow separation because the shear rate is low and the shear stress oscillates. Low shear makes these areas susceptible to platelet adhesion, intimal hyperplasia, and eventually atherosclerosis. Furthermore, areas of high shear stress can cause endothelial damage. The end result of all this leads to graft failure.
If this is the case, is there anything we can do to improve the hemodynamics at the anastomosis and achieve better graft patency?
To start with, you could use an end-to-end anastomosis, which will definitely reduce a lot of the flow disturbances. Although this is not always practical. In any case, ensuring the graft anastomoses are at an acute angle will certainly help. Various patches and vein cuffs have been employed to try and improve the hemodynamics at distal anastomoses by producing what's called a cohesive vortex flow pattern, which theoretically increases the shear stress at the anastomosis, reducing intimal hyperplasia.
We've talked about hemodynamics in grafts. What about aneurysms?
I'm sure we are all aware that the two main problems with aneurysms are rupture and thrombus buildup leading to embolization. Let's take a look at each one. If you've ever wondered why large aneurysms tend to rupture and smaller ones don't, a factor to take into consideration is that wall stress is a function of the transmural pressure, the inside radius of the vessel, and its wall thickness. It also explains why rupture is more common in hypertensive patients. Laplace's law is often quoted when talking about aneurysms. It states that the wall tension is the product of the transmural pressure and the radius of the cylinder. However, Laplace's law is only truly applicable to very thin-walled structures such as balloons and soap bubbles. Aneurysms are usually spherico-cylindrical in shape, but this does not change the fact that wall stress is directly proportional to transmural pressure and the inner radius of the vessel and inversely proportional to wall thickness.
How does it all work in practice?
Well, what I need is a balloon. Let me go and grab it. One moment, please. I'm going to take this rather floppy balloon with a diameter of about 2 to 2.5 centimeters and start blowing it up to an average aneurysm size of 6 centimeters. Here goes. As the volume of material in the wall of the balloon is not being added to, the wall inevitably becomes thinner. Let's just keep going. A few more breaths. Oh, that's a bit of a shame, boys and girls. Our aneurysm has just popped. Although the wall area is the same before and after the balloon pops, as it expands, the wall stress is greatly increased owing to both a decrease in wall thickness and an increase in radius. For any given pressure within our expanding balloon model, tripling the radius and decreasing the wall thickness causes the circumferential wall stress per unit area of wall to increase by a factor of about 12. Obviously, our balloon is an oversimplified model as compared to a real aneurysm, where multiple other factors come into play, especially the presence of thrombus. As the wall of an aneurysm dilates, the flow at the edges becomes sluggish, leading to the formation of multiple layers of thrombus, which maintain the diameter of the non-aneurysmal vessel. There are two potential outcomes of this. First, the thrombus buildup may add to the thickness of the wall and reduce wall stress, possibly providing some protection against rupture. Second, it may simply transmit the pressure to the wall regardless, with no other effects. Experimental models have demonstrated that thrombus may reduce wall stress by as much as 50%. Either way, the bigger it gets, just like my balloon, it's going to eventually pop. Even if the presence of thrombus reduces wall stress, it is not always benign. The layers of clot can be loosely adherent in parts and may break off, resulting in embolization further downstream, which can result in limb ischemia. Popliteal aneurysms are notorious for this, as I'm sure you know.
One thing I'm curious about is why aortic aneurysms tend to adopt the shape that we often see. Can you explain this?
Yes, of course. I'm sure many of you have seen 3D reconstructions and images of abdominal aortic aneurysms, which are often used to plan interventions such as EVAR or open surgery. Unlike our balloon model, they are rarely axisymmetric. As they elongate, they tend to bow forward at the top and deviate to the left. The expansion in the anterior plane that we often see occurs because the vertebral column lies posteriorly, limiting any increase in size in this direction. This asymmetry can increase wall stress in these areas, making the anterior-posterior planes prone to rupture. You will notice in reality that this is where it often happens.
That's all we have time for in this second episode on arterial hemodynamics. We hope you now have a better understanding of the hemodynamics that occur during exercise, claudication, limb ischemia, and in aneurysms. Stay tuned for our next Vascular Fundamentals podcast, where we will turn our attention to the venous system. And remember, all ESVS podcasts are available open access in Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and also the ESVS library. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Yes, bye for now, and see you all again next time.